Hello, this is Pixelated Playgrounds, a gaming book club podcast discussing the art and craft of video games. I'm Brian Skirsha.
And I'm Josh Galecki. And today we're talking about Chants of Sennar, developed by Runedisc and published by Focus Entertainment. The game was released for PC, Switch, PS4, and Xbox One in 2023. And we'll be talking spoilers here, so heads up if you're sensitive to that.
Yeah, and I think you brought this mostly to my attention, Josh, as a fan of these deductive logic games, knowing we were both fans of them, actually. This immediately piqued my interest as well. I have to say, though, this was a harder one for me. I'm not as much of a linguist as you are.
It is an abiding hobby of mine, for sure. I do enjoy geeking out about it. And when I heard that there was a game trying to take that and run with it, that game was Heaven's Vault, and I still haven't gotten around to playing it. But then Chants of Sennar comes out a couple years later, and I'm like, okay, this game is in the zeitgeist a little bit. Actually, it got a IGF nomination recently, too, so critically acclaimed as well. So it was a good time to pick it up and run with it.
Couldn't agree more. And I do have one thing to say about, you mentioned Heaven's Gate, is that the one?
Or Heaven's Vault, one of the two.
Yeah. At any rate, that game, neither of us have played, yes? And I know we both thought about playing it. We probably should go back and check that one out, huh?
Isn't it by the 80 Days devs?
Yes, it is. The 80 Days, the Overboards, a very good developer that we like the games of, so no reason for us not to return to that one. But anyway, this is a podcast about not that game. This is about Chants of Sennar. So you said Runedisc. I thought it was Runedisc, but hey, that's fine either way.
Oh,
I think
yes,
the idea
it
gets it.
Is it? Can I claim French pronunciation on that?
Yeah, go for it.
No, it's not proper pronunciation there anyways. But Runedisc is two friends whose names I don't have in front of me, but this is their second game. They started, they released a first game in 2018, and this game, I think, has done much better for them.
Yeah, that's right. So two friends, as you said, hobbyists, really, Julian Moya and Thomas Panwell. They started working on this game in March 2020, but, as you mentioned, put out a multiplayer brawler called Varian in 2018 on PC and Switch. This game obviously took off in a much bigger way, as you mentioned, and that hence why we are here talking about it. You know, I think we both came to this game through word of mouth. And it is also just so striking to look at, like right off the bat, it kind of hits you in the face with the color palette and the style and the art. It's just, it's gorgeous, really striking game.
Yeah. The dev studio is based in Toulouse, France. Mm-hmm. And one of the things out there in France and Belgium is they have a kind of a different comics history than we do. We're all focused on the superheroes, whereas their big names are like Tintin and the Smurfs and things like that. But there was a style called Ligne Claire, or Clear Line, that was developed by the Tintin comic artist and kind of became its own thing over there. So I think that this game was very influenced by that. And in fact, if you take a look at some of their shaders, you can kind of see the that kind of like Pantone dot matrix printer effect that they replicated for the shaders as well. So a little bit of a love letter with that.
The color palette choices varying between the floors are just extremely on point. Just immediately very appealing, and I couldn't look away from it, really. Like right from that initial sort of yellow of the title screen just sort of smacks you in the face. Like, it's not really a palette you see very often, and it really, really caught my eye. At any rate, as you said, these two based in Toulouse, and the publisher that they're working with, Focus, who's headquartered in France, apparently after that first game, they didn't really know quite what they were, they realized they didn't know quite what they were doing about marketing a game, so decided to go with a publisher angle, and those executives were quite impressed, so much so that they helped fund the rest of that development cycle. much to the surprise of the two developers, which is always a nice story to hear. You know, you find people enthusiastic about your work, and the rest is history, especially in this case. We mentioned Heaven's Vault up top, which I did confirm the title of to be Heaven's Vault. and apparently this game came into shape after Julian Moya played that game and ironically didn't enjoy it, which is a thread that we are now seeing in indie game developers that we are following or covering, interestingly enough.
I mean, you've probably heard me say on another podcast before that, you know, when a game developer sees a mechanic that they're like, no, this should have been done better, they're the ones who can go out and, you know, try it a different way, do it better, and more power to them for doing that.
Absolutely. You know, I'm kind of down with that, like taking the power of your creativity and showing what could be is, you know, kind of the, you know, what are we doing here if not saying, no, I want this video game podcast to be more like this and putting our own little spin on it out in the world. But yeah, that's neither here nor there. Let's talk a little bit more about the old Chants of Sennar, yes?
In Chants of Sennar, you wake up at the bottom of a tower. So where else do you go but up? Along the way, you meet and interact with five different groups of people, each with their own language, culture, and architecture. And that's where you come in with the famous translation mechanics for this game. Because easily, you know, this game has a lot of puzzles in it, but the translation puzzle is the most notable. And I think the most original, too.
Oh yeah, couldn't agree more. It's a fun mechanic, and there are some mysteries about it that I still haven't figured out till right now. I'll talk about some of those. Some of those are good, some of those are a little frustrating, but at the end of the day, I really enjoyed the translation mechanic in this game, and it was a fine thread to take me all the way through the game's, I don't know, maybe 7-hour runtime. But I want to talk a little bit about the title, because I realized just as we were about to record this podcast that I had no idea what the heck Chants of Sennar actually meant. So I went on the old Wikipedia and found out that Sennar is the Greek translation for the biblical location of the Tower of Babel.
Huh.
So yeah, they're basically drawing directly on, like, this is the language of the Tower of Babel, or the languages of the Tower of Babel.
Well, then chants as well, I believe, is French for songs.
Well, there you go. And the music in this game, quite nice. There's some nice songs in this particular Sennar, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
No, absolutely. Yeah, the great songs, great, like, between that and the architecture and the art, it just really set the stage for the game. Like, you felt like you are in some, you know, exotic locale. It was not your typical fantasy, high fantasy kind of milieu.
Absolutely. Very, very specifically drawing on Sumeria, you know, Sennar, Shinar, or in Western parlance, Sumer. So yes, very Babylonian in nature.
Well, one of the interviews I read from the devs was talking about how wide-ranging they attempted to be with their influences. So not only like Mesopotamia and the Levantine, but also like even the cathedrals around the block in France, or some of the architecture of India, especially when they're getting the five different groups, the five different peoples. Each of them does have their own kind of like setting the stage sort of thing that goes from the buildings you're walking by to the very language you're translating.
I mean, it makes sense, right? The Tower of Babel, like the story therein, is basically talking about how people came from all around to help build the tower to the heavens, to try and pierce the veil of Celestia, so to speak. Did you read the Ted Chiang story about the Tower of Babylon, by the way? I feel like both read that. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good story. That was a good story. Although I did like The Merchant and the Alchemist Gate a little bit better for something in a similar kind of style.
Yeah, yeah. I thought of that story when I was playing this, because there's not a ton of things that reference the Tower of Babel, and that's like one of the popular pieces of sci-fi that does. So it came to mind. But at any rate, let's talk a little bit more about that language mechanic, because it comes up front and center very quickly. And I want to maybe hit on the tutorial before we go into like the journey up the tower, because I think the tutorial is pretty elegantly done, right? You just are opening and closing gates, you know? It's very much a binary, teaching you open and closed, so that you sort of are starting to understand the glyphs that the game is putting in front of you.
Yeah, the game will put glyphs or symbols in front of you that make up the words of a language, one language for each of the five stages you go to. The very first time you come across this, you're at a sign in front of a lever, and the only thing you can do is look at the glyphs and pull the lever, and you're like, okay, this kind of goes from open to close, and there's two symbols in each position. Maybe they're connected. And then as you're going through, that is a pretty nice tutorial. Yeah, it limits your actions very much so that you really kind of have to pull everything together. Like, oh, I'm supposed to open here. I'm supposed to close here. You soon meet up with another inhabitant of the tower, and the two of you pull switches and make your way through some gates and doors to reach the next stage.
Yeah, so it's also immediately introducing sort of this puzzle mechanic, like the environment will react to your doing of things, basically defining the game's entire loop, which is interpret glyphs, use them to interact with the environment, environment reacts to your interpretation and action.
Two other key things I want to point out is, first, we see the glyphs on the sign, which, you know, written language, we expect that to happen, but when you've first talk to the other person, they have little speech bubbles that pop up with the glyphs inside of them as well. So it's kind of being used as a spoken language too, and you kind of piece that together very early on. Another thing it does when you reach the end of that little canal puzzle is to bring open the notebook, which is when you have to guess what things mean or use context clues to say, oh, this glyph means open, this glyph means close. And once you get that correct, then those glyphs become translated for you everywhere else.
Yeah, I liked this as sort of a way for the game to confirm and lock in things so that you're not consistently building on, say, a house of cards with one busted card at its base. But I also didn't quite understand how they decided when you have had enough context for the notebook to appear. I found myself with, at the end of my entire playthrough, still knowing the answer to several words and not having the notebook pop up to allow me to confirm them.
Yeah, that actually happened with me in Act 2. And I'm like, I solved this puzzle already. I know what they mean. Luckily, nothing in the game is gated behind that except achievements, which...
Yes.
Well, some people would be driven crazy by that, but those are also the people who will look things up and make sure they find that exact point they need to be in.
Well, it probably tells you exactly the type of player I am, that I just left them undiscovered and continued on my merry way. That was Act 2 for me too, by the way, which I think is leading us to our joint conclusion that that is by far my least favorite act.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that.
We'll get to that though. Yeah, I do like the sort of lock-in thing. It's very satisfying to like, yep, I got this. I know exactly what that means. Or if you don't and you get it screwed up, it's nice to be like, oh, well, I guess I have to revisit and see if I can put a different spin on what this word I thought meant, pull or carry was or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I do think that for me, those sketchbook, the translation sketchbook, that worked 90% of the time. But there were certain times where the picture was a little more vague into what they were looking for, or even there. I remember one time in Act 1 specifically, where like I knew the word for pot, like a ceramic pot, and there's a sketchbook picture of someone wheel throwing and making a pot, and I kept trying to throw pot in there, but I needed to throw in the verb create, which I got by blind guessing. And I think this game kind of had a little bit of what the Oprah Din problem was, where you can kind of like guess and check your way through things. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, it's just 10% of these puzzles where they had it, though. Most of the time it was easy enough for me to figure out, but sometimes I felt like they could have helped out a little more with that, or they should have. They should have signposted things a bit more.
Yeah, I recall a couple of guess and check instances myself, and I don't know, I'm of two minds on this, because on one hand, I'm kind of glad they let you do that. Like, I wouldn't like to not be able to guess and check my way through it, you know? And also, I don't exactly know how you would mechanically implement not being able to guess and check your way through it.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I feel like it, in the mechanics they used, yes, you can guess and check your way through it. But in terms of like player fun, being like, okay, let's go through combination 5-3-7 right. 2 and see if that has like,
well, there's always going to be degenerative play, right? Like, and I feel like if I came in with like 1 of 3 and had to guess and check against 17 symbols, I'd be like, well, fuck this, I'm going to go actually do my homework. Cause I'm not one to like try the combination lock for, 0001, 0002, you know, I'm going to go and like try and figure that out. But if I'm like 90% of the way there and I've like 3 symbols that I think it could be, sure. Yeah. Maybe I'll do a little brute forcing.
There is a nice thing that you can do, when you have a symbol and you don't know its meaning yet, then you can click on it and you get like 20 or 30 characters to type out whatever the hell you want to type out. So your random ass guess as to what this means, you can throw in there. And then whenever you see that symbol or someone says that symbol, then you see your random guess. And that can really help you piece things together because you're like, I'm pretty sure I saw the symbol 2 screens back. Let me go back there and check to see what it was.
And it gives you some occasionally hilarious instances of completely misunderstanding what someone is saying.
Dangers of translation, right?
Exactly. I've definitely guessed and checked my way into some truly weird sentences in this game. But, you know, I don't know. I think that's kind of fun. I like that they let you freeform that. Like, I'm glad they don't give you like a set of choices or something like that. That would be much more limiting. And the fact that they just let you freeform type in like whatever the hell you want into that field really like helps make the playthrough your own and gives you a sense of ownership over the deduction that's happening.
You know, that freeform thing, I think looking back, that was a really key part of the game's feel, because if it was like multiple choice, does this mean food or bicycles or what have you? You're like, okay, well, it's got to be one of these 4 things. But with the freeform stuff, it's really like you can think anything. It's like regular translation, you know. I'm sure other people do that for fun too.
Yeah, like, does this mean sus or does this mean alpha, or does this you can you know, I'm pretending apparently that I'm a zoomer, but you can impart all of your own like goofy little meanings onto whatever these people are saying, or you know, your own shorthand even. Like, there are definitely turns of phrase that I perhaps as a, you know, North American Midwestern white person would say that perhaps someone else playing this game in a different context wouldn't. And I think it's interesting because I feel like this game would also be a nightmare to translate.
Oh, maybe. Oh, but yeah, I think that's right. Like, you put your own spin on it. It's like you are translated and you're like, I think this is what this means. And it's your own guess, your own clue, your own personal idea for where it's going with that.
Yeah. And another interesting thing about all of these languages, because I don't think we've mentioned this specific portion of it yet, is all of the languages of the various levels of the tower are not just different in that they're different words or symbols for different meanings, but they also have different structures. Like, there are linguistic constructs that differ between them as well.
Now, this was probably my favorite part of the game. Each of the glyphs had an internal logic to it. This is something I learned even in Act 1, where it's like, oh, I think it was like all the verbs look like this, or all the place names have a line underneath them, or something like that, or the preacher glyph was a combination of man and seek or something like that. So it's like you kind of learn how things go, or later on you learn that the different languages do plurals differently, whereas Act 1 with the devotees, you just double up on the people. You're like, me, you. And some of my researching for this, I found out there are actually languages who use that. It's kind of rare, and some of these features they're pulling out are kind of rare, but I think they all exist like in the natural space of languages.
That's interesting. I mean, I'm not shocked to hear that, but I wonder, like, how much of a language or, you know, linguistic background these developers had to sort of understand the various types of language constructs that exist in the world and import those into the game, or if it was something that they learned for the purposes of making this game, you know?
One of the developers I heard is a big language nerd.
So you have something in common.
Oh, for sure, for sure. Before we get too much into the specifics of the people and the language there, one thing I do want to talk about, and a kind of like almost a broader tutorial thing that I think this game did very well, is in Act 1 and Act 2, the first two languages you are deciphering, it's a very concrete sort of language. Like, it's like, here's the word for pottery, here's the word for, seek or talk or things like that. But you get to Act 3 and then, to a lesser extent, Act 4, and they start talking about more abstract ideals, and you're kind of like thrown into the open a little more, where they're like, in Act 1, they only give you 4 or 5 new symbols at a time and ask you to translate them and confirm them. Whereas Act 3, they're like, here's 20 symbols right at the beginning. And you're like slowly being like, is this what it is here? Is that, what is my random ass guess right? Act 3 was, I think, my favorite part when you first get into those gardens.
I kind of agree. And it is interesting to me how they layer that, because to your point, like, it starts off slow and then quickly ramps up. And then by, Area 5, you know, the top of the tower with the exiles, you're just getting the whole thing all at once, and they're basically having you do comparative analysis instead of any actual, you know, context, which is interesting. Like, I kind of liked that, I especially because it kept things fresh. Like, I think if you were just trying to discover how languages work the same time on every floor, quote unquote, of the tower, it would be boring after, you know, floor 2. But I liked that they changed the mode of discovery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did change things around too. I think Act 3 worked really well, and it was very linear. Like, you would do an area and then move on to the next one. You'd do an area and move on to the next one. Whereas Act 4, and actually Act 2, once you got to the end of it, had the problem of like, where am I supposed to go? What am I supposed to know here? I think that's part of the reason Act 2 dragged on so long. Act 4 had that kind of maze structure, but I didn't feel like it was as bad there.
Yeah, I have other things that bothered me about Act 2, but perhaps we can discuss those as we talk through each of the floors. To that end, do we want to start our journey up the tower?
Yeah, so Act 1, you're kind of in this desert oasis architecture. You meet the devotees, people who have come to the tower to worship God. They're very peaceful. Their language and economy is very much based on simple exchange, and very religious as well. Like, there's the abbey, there's the temple that you go through, there's the graveyard, and there's the murdered preacher, whose backstory I'm not sure I ever got. I don't know, maybe the monster from later on came by and snapped his neck or something.
Oh, no. I think he just fell. Like, a part of the tower collapsed, and he fell to his death in that catacomb area. You find his body.
That was always a loose thread for me. I'm like, oh, I guess we'll learn about this later, and then he's never mentioned again.
No, he dead. As they say in devotee language. But I do like the sort of pretty simple structure of this. Like, it's very much a point to point. Like, I think this is the game's most typical adventure game arc. Like, you understand and help the poor man so you can get the clue for the key to go to the preacher's house, to get the lens, to go to the cemetery.
The 12-step fetch quest.
Yeah, it's very much like, hey, this is an adventure game too, right? And it's teaching you, like, you need this item to do that, to understand this guy, to get to the next area. And eventually, you, you know, unlock the puzzle that allows you to take the back door around the gate that the warriors are guarding, which is the entrance to the broad, you know, higher up into the tower.
I do think this act was good about kind of introducing that it's not just about the translation puzzles too. And maybe that was the heaviest in this act. I think it might have been, now that you mention it, but there's like environmental puzzles too, like slide the beds to get the ladder in the right place puzzle, or things like that, where you, kind of more standard video game puzzles, which I thought was a good change of pace, especially since you never saw the same puzzle twice here.
Well, that's the thing, is like there are different types of puzzles throughout each of the levels, and this levels were by far the most straightforward, which is fitting because it's the first floor. You know, you're very much coming to this game thinking, well, this is a deductive language game, but also you're controlling it like a point and click adventure game, at least if you're playing on PC. And so it's very logical for you to be like, oh, well, I'm going to do some point and click adventure puzzles too. And then,
oh man, there's a bird's nest in that tree. That's yeah. important somehow.
Exactly. I know he's got a fucking key up there. That fucking bird. Anyway, played too many adventure games back in the day. That's once you do get through all of your adventure game hooks, you make your way in the roundabout way to the second area, our apparently joint nadir of the game, the fortress.
Yeah, the fortress, this was the warrior's level. They have a very kind of like combative and imperative language, like very commanding. Do this. Carry small box. Carry large box. And it was also, I think, the heaviest section of stealth in this game, which is probably, I mean, I can understand why they put it in, mix things up. But I don't know. I feel like there were stealth sections in the Warriors that I didn't mind, and there were some really long time taxes, it felt like.
Yeah, I this is the entire reason that I think this is my least favorite floor, and every time this mechanic reappeared, I was like just constantly saying why. The stealth mechanics in this game are not its strong suit. I think you gotta stick to your strengths with games like this, and this game's strength is not its stealth mechanics. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that kept me sane during these portions is, at the very least, you know, you're restarting on screen. You're not losing that much time. To your point about time taxes, I think it was relatively lenient in that regard.
Oh, I mean, there were a couple of times where you had to blend in with a patrol. Just walk around.
Yeah.
And then I had to double back, so I had to do it again. And I'm just like, ugh, ugh.
No, I agree with you. Like, I think these stealth sections are kind of a regrettable inclusion to what mm-hmm. otherwise seems like a pretty cohesive experience. And I understand why they're there. You know, I think the sort of whole warrior ecosystem is a little less fitting to the rest of the whole game situation. But I understand why it's there, because they are kind of the outliers as, mm-hmm. you know, the combative class of this, the whole situation going on here. But that doesn't mean we needed to do a stealth mechanic.
Or as much. I think another thing, this was more so than the stealth sections, what got me about this act was the level design. There were several times near the end where I would go down one fork in the road and find out I was in the wrong fork in the road. I needed to go down the other one first. But it wasn't like clearly signposted that you should go down this one. Or, you know, this game has some beautiful architecture. Sometimes the game likes to make you look at all that architecture as you're walking along a screen. So there were some, when you're backtracking and noticing it again and then backtracking, the length of it loses the effect it had the first time around.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think one of the things that I'll pivot and say I did like about this is with every floor, the color palette changes, and it does have once again, a very nice color palette, and to your point, some great art. I think the thing they were maybe feeling out with the fortress level compared to the other ones is it is just too expansive. I feel like it's by far the biggest floor, and if it's not, you know, I apologize. It just felt that way. And it's,
well, you need space to do your stealth sections.
And yeah, agreed. But regrettably. But it's also the easiest to get lost in. And even to your point, once you eventually in this level, you find a disguise, so you don't need to be stealthy anymore. But that just means all the areas you used to be stealthing through, which were, you know, was supposed to make it an interesting thing to traverse through, is now just a time tax, to your point. So just, you know, perhaps There's multiple reasons, it seems, that we both decided this was not the favorite of floors, but I did like the color palette.
Oh, you know, now that I'm thinking about it too, do you remember the bell ringing at the end of it?
Oh, yeah.
I did have to look that up. That puzzle was too obscure for me to figure out on my own.
That was a tough one. Yeah, the really tough one. And however, I really enjoyed what they did with like the state change of, you know, all the people rushing through at the end. The idea behind this being the warriors are waiting for, you know, the bell to ring so that it signals the chosen one has come or something like that. And after that point, it removes all the guards and allows you to go through up into the next level. I don't know, like, interesting foreshadowing in this floor, interesting sort of dichotomy with the initial devotee section, which is very peaceful and chill. But at the same time, like, perhaps a bit too of an abrasive, you know, jarring shift for the second floor of this game.
Yeah, they're showing different cultures, too. One thing that I did like, too, is that you'll find... this is the first time you see... I call them these little Rosetta Stone objects that have two different languages. The first case is like a shield that talks about dying in battle or something like that. And it has it both in devotee language and warrior language. And you use that to figure out that, oh, it's important. You know, like the warriors have this little plural tag that comes up again and again. It's a little glyph that makes the next word or the previous word plural instead. So you learn things like that. And when you get up to Act 3, you see another one of these signs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do like the sort of Rosetta Stone or comparative analysis, as I called it earlier, like sections to help you discover language. You know, using what you've learned in previous floors to help you in the floor you're in now is always a empowering feeling. Another sort of motif I found, at least in these first two floors, is you're in both of them, you're disguising yourselves or trying to blend in with officials. You know, blending in with the priests, then blending in with the warriors. It's an interesting little thing. You know, you learn the most when you are embedding yourself within the society, is perhaps what they are trying to say there.
Maybe. After you finish ringing the bells and all the warriors are running around all pell-mell, you can go up the elevator to Act 3.
That's right. The Garden of the Bards, I suppose.
Chosen Ones, Bards, whatever you want to have.
Musicians... degenerates, perhaps.
yeah, they lean into it.
They do, yeah. They think of themselves pretty highly. And apparently
their ideals are music and comedy.
And art, yes. Music and yeah. They're very abstract and lazy. However, they also employ servants, as you'll find later. It's a very interesting level. This is the garden level, and underneath the garden is the sewer. And you'll find these beautiful sort of flowing golden rivers up above. And you'll find the same yellow water underground too. And it takes an entirely different connotation down there.
I also kind of like, there was one moment where someone dropped a locket into the sewers. And that's the only time you see like the bards looking down. They're like, oh man, my shiny trinket's down there. Guess it's gone forever.
Yeah. It's like, come on, man. You don't know a single person that's working to, you know, run on the treadmill that powers your little fan to keep you cool.
Yeah, I definitely think there was supposed to be some decadence going on there.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And one of the main sort of touch points in this level is you getting a coin that'll let you into a theater so you can view the comedy show that, like, calls the warriors stupid and, you know, calls... the devotees ignorant and stuff like that, and eventually talks about how to, you know, take the specific right turns that allow you to continue to ascend into the higher levels of the tower. It's an interesting level for sure. Like, definitely more environmental storytelling about the society itself in this one than puzzling, at least to my mind.
Yeah, for sure. Although I do think this level had the biggest linguistic puzzle, which was talking about like the different quirks of each language. The bard's language was not in subject-verb order, like man bites dog. It was in object-subject-verb order. Dog, man bites.
Yoda language.
Yoda, I am. Yoda language. And was not expecting that at all, and eventually figured out, and I'm like, oh, that's really cool that they did that. Because none of my translations were making sense until I realized that, oh, the thing that's being done things to is said first.
Yeah, I mean, that totally makes sense, and I hadn't thought of it like that. I was just kind of mimicking what I saw on the page, but the breaking it down into an actual linguistic construct is probably something you're picking up on much more, having studied multiple languages, than I, as a mere native English speaker, would do. But that is really interesting, and I guess that leads to my understanding it as Yoda language.
I like it. Gets the point across.
Exactly. But you're welcome out there, fellow dummies.
But you go through, go through the theater, you get the map to get through the temple, and then you go into the mine where the monster lurks.
Yes. So this is sort of I thought of this as sort of an interstitial level between the gardens and the next area. And of course, we're bringing back both of our favorite mechanic, the stealth. You're avoiding the inexplicably present monster in the tower. What's the deal with the monster? Why does this exist?
I don't know. It's a tower, man. You're going to get a monster eventually.
Sure. Every tower has a monster. Absolutely. Why not? This was another sort of inexplicable addition to me, but hey, it added tension, which I guess is helpful in some regards.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there was a single stealth section in all of the Act 3, so I think they were trying to use a system they develop already as a kind of pace break in order to kind of, like, segment off the bards and the alchemists later on, too. Like, you want to kind of have an explanation for why each group stays where it is. It doesn't go higher up in the tower. The devotees don't go higher because the warriors stop them. The warriors don't go higher because, they like kind of revere, they call the bards the chosen ones.
Yeah, they're guarding. Yeah.
And there's even a sign when you get up there that says, "Warriors, turn around," in warrior language. Mm-hmm. And then the bards, they don't see the next level because, there's this monster in the way.
You were helping me understand the stratification so much better than my simple explanation of all these folks just don't like each other.
They don't do that either. And the bards are too lazy to go down and see the warriors.
Yeah. I think that your sort of inbuilt explanation for physical barriers between the areas is good and helpful, but at least, given the fact that I almost barely realized it was there, probably unnecessary. I mean, it could just simply be a disconnect and like people liking to be amongst each other, which, as we talk about perhaps the end of the game, maybe can be explained a little better.
Well, you're talking about, you said earlier, if you had to do like a whole bunch of translation puzzles in a row, that would be a bit much. You'd get tired of doing that. So I think the stealth was there as that kind of like, here is something else you can do. I think it could have been done better, but I think that's the function it has.
I agree, and agree with the function aspect, but aside from the function aspect, I like your explanation of how it sort of builds itself into why these are stratified different societies in the first place. Also a helpful thing to understand sort of the tower at large.
Yeah, because you don't have a lot of history of the tower being revealed to you. And it turns out that that's because everyone who you see so far is kind of like newcomers or pretty like uninterested in the tower itself, which makes Act 4 fun, because this is the scientist level, the alchemist level.
Right. You emerge out of the mines, or rather the corridors that you were being hunted down by the monster into the laboratory. Scientists and number puzzles abound.
Hey, if you're going to have your own language system, you got to design your own number system too. I dug that puzzle.
Yeah.
And there was only, I think, one or two number-based puzzles.
There were, I think they were interesting. Like, in addition to some of the other linguistic constructs constructs or concepts we've seen before. This one invented a number system, which included complex numbers. You know, numbers basically going up to, I think we got up to 5 digits in this one. Uh-huh. So that was interesting in sort of learning how those were constructed. It reminded me a bit of Roman numerals. And that helped me understand how it worked.
They had an interesting way the numbers were devised, in which it was like a 4-quadrant number thing. So you had your top left, top right, bottom left, and bottom right corners. And each of those would have a different number, and you had to figure out, like, is this the tens place? Is this the this or
thousands,
that place?
Yeah.
At least they kept it base 10 for the rest of us.
Yeah, I was going to say, could you imagine if they decided to do, like, hexadecimal in that? Jesus.
I mean, that'd be easy enough for me, programming-wise, but if they're like, you know, this culture is all about base 7.
Jesus. Talk about insufferable. But, no, I agree, you know, helpfully base 10. Also, you know, basically think of, like, the top and bottom bars in a Roman numeral. Instead, it's a central bar going down the middle vertically. And then you can sort of understand, as you said, Josh, thousands, hundreds, tens, ones.
But you have to figure that out, which is a fun little puzzle.
It is, yeah. They you know, let you explore a library and laboratories and a mine. And you're basically in this area understanding concepts of math and chemistry, or, you know, alchemy, I suppose it is. Figuring out the numbers for temperatures and pressures, and the symbols for minerals and ores in order to create a key that will allow you to ascend to the next level.
Yeah, once you get the key, you can go through the door to, I think they were called fairies in the scientist language, but these become the people who built the tower in Act 5.
Yeah, basically mystical beings. And yeah, the translation for the mathematicians, the scientists, was fairies. So good job, scientists.
we're very, you know, I guess they are alchemists, more kind of a brand of scientists, but it did seem a little out of place. Like, we're all about seeking knowledge and also fairies.
Yeah, I was going to say, but at the bottom of it all, obviously, it's just magic. Okay.
Hey, these monsters started arriving out of nowhere. We gotta do something.
Right. If you got monsters, you got to have your fairies. But yeah, I like this floor, but it was the most difficult for me, like sussing out that number system and keeping it all in your brain while you figure out how to, you know, operate the chemical machinery was, it took some doing.
They weren't unfair, or like they had the information you had in front of you once you did all the exploring you needed to do. Like, this game wasn't trying to be like, you need to click this pixel on the screen, otherwise you won't get anywhere. It was trying to give you what you needed to go. I think that's why my earlier complaint about the notebook, I felt like they didn't give me what I needed at that point.
Yes, that's exactly it. It's like the floor two is the only floor I didn't complete the lexicon for. And, you know, it was mostly probably due to not wanting to stay on that floor any longer. But, you know, I hear you on that. And I think just as like a general rule, like I think this game's puzzles like stretch the limit of what I want from a game in terms of puzzles. Like, I think this went right up to the edge, because there were certain ones, like especially in the laboratory section, where like, all right, I figured out the numerical system, but boy, do I not want to figure out like the next 3 ores and what temperatures they need to go on based on the notes that I have here. I'm just going to look that up. I get it. The I get it button was in full effect for this one.
Fair enough.
And I'm sure there's other people that are like, man, you just, you know, that's like the whole point of this whole thing. But, you know, to me, like once I had the epiphany, that was the jolt of serotonin I needed, and I was done. I was ready to move on at that point.
One thing that I did like about the scientist language is that it had numbers. Like, nobody else cares about numbers but the scientists, which gives them a nice flavor over there. Like, we're the only ones who care about measuring things, at least in what the game's telling you.
Yeah, there were plurals in the previous ones, but there was not specifics in terms of numerology. So that was, I agree, definitely helpful and interesting. Alchemists, they like their numbers.
Well, you get through the fairy door of Act 4, and you arrive in Act 5, the Anchorites. Now, are you familiar with the medieval term Anchorite?
I'm not familiar with it as a medieval term. I'm familiar with it because I just played a Star Wars game where they were like hermits and monks.
Yeah, this was like an old thing people would do in monasteries where they would build themselves a room-sized coffin, more or less, and spend all day in there. And, you know, they would get food and water and everything and pass out buckets for their shovel or for their waste or whatnot. And some of them would even, like, talk to people. People would come see these very holy people sealed up in a monastery. But that's the official term the game gives to these people on Act 5 of the Tower, which I think is relevant for talking about what they do and what they are.
Yeah, these are the gamers. They hook themselves up.
The holy, holy gamers.
The holy gamers, yes. They hook themselves up to their VR headsets and sit in a chair and shit in a bucket like Cartman on South Park. So, I mean, in so many words, they are the people who had the technology to build this tower, and now they are completely cut off from reality because they're staring at their video games or their screens, I suppose. Interesting twist at the top level of this tower.
Yeah, you get there and like no one cares about you. Well, almost no one. But yeah, you get there and they're like, go away. I'm missing my sitcom here.
Yeah, exactly. I gotta win this game. Yeah, there is one part where you walk in and there's four of them and they're clearly just playing a four-person video game.
Now, I thought it was interesting too, like even with the alchemist, you see kind of like steampunk levels of technology, and you get in here and everyone's wearing like VR life suit sort of things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely big jump in kind of
tech.
What you're seeing. Yeah, big jump in tech.
Yeah, and you know, you can kind of view this tower as a progression of technology if I'm thinking back on it, you know, starting with you know, very basic religion into sort of ordered societies, you know, feudalistic militaristic command, up through the Enlightenment and art, up into science and technology, and then into shitting in a bucket in your mom's basement. The natural order of things. But anyway, these guys get you to, or eventually, after exploring this floor, you determine that what you need to do is reunify the tower. The guy that you find up in the Anchorites exile location says, I created you to unify the tower.
Mm-hmm. What you find out is that the Anchorites built the tower and everybody came and started hating on each other. So they were like, peace, I'm out. I'm just gonna VR for the rest of my infinite days here. But there were these barriers between the people of the tower because they could not speak with each other. And there was even this AI called Exile that had been like created by the Anchorites and was propagating this and trying to bring about the tower's demise now by cordoning it off. I almost feel like maybe he had something to do with the monsters being loosed or something as a kind of like insurance policy, like block off accesses and whatnot, but I'm not sure if that's headcanon or not.
I think it might not be, because the heads of the monsters bear a striking resemblance to the head of the AI.
Fair point.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something there, perhaps. But yeah, to your point, the tower as it is now, due perhaps to the influence of this AI, is separated, and that is not how the Anchorites originally intended it. So they task you with going back to some of these portals, or these, I guess I would call them telephone booths, that you found throughout the course of your journey up the tower in various hidden alleyways and corners. And what you can do is teleport between them. You can, you know, use one to get to the various levels of the tower. And at each one, there is a phone call going on between two levels of the tower that you can use all of your accumulated knowledge to help translate between the two.
Yeah, I thought this was actually a kind of cool thing when you come across the... They're like waypoints, you know, you zap around, fast travel, here to there. But there's like an extra little bit of the waypoint where you can go to the screen and it's like, oh, here's a Zoom call between two people here. And there's people speaking in languages you haven't heard of yet. But that kind of like hints to the depth of the game at the beginning. Because I think the very first one you come across, there's like a devotee trying to speak to a scientist. And you see the devotee language and you're like, okay, I know some of these words. And you see the scientist and you're like, oh,
I don't know any of that.
That's crazy, crazy talk, what's going on over there. But once you are on Act 5, you've gone through, interacted with all four of these peoples, and you're able to translate between the two. When you successfully translate, it creates a connection between the two layers of the tower. And this connection actually has, like, effects on the level that you're on. Like when you create the connection between the devotees and the warriors no longer guard the gate and block the devotees from coming up. They're hanging out and listening to a guitar concert after that.
That's right. So the bards play music for the warriors. The warriors help the scientists by destroying the monsters that are haunting the mines that they are working in.
The devotees give the bards' servants a place to chill out and not be slaves.
Yeah, I thought that was perhaps the darkest one, is the devotees distracted the servants, basically, which, you know, I guess is a, you know, fitting. But the scientists helping the devotees, what was that one? I'm looking back at my notes and
the plants were dying.
Right, yes, the devotees' plants were dying and the scientists
The alchemists are like, hey, we're buddies, we're brothers, we used to be the same people, and then you got all lazy. And what else was there? Like, oh, the bards also play music for the warriors.
Yeah, bards play music for the warriors, yep. So there's all of these sort of, I guess, synergies between these levels of the tower that were cut off, and hence all of the strife that you've been sort of tumbling your way through as you make your way up the tower. It's an interesting little thing that, you know, you reconnect all of the various levels of the tower, you remove all of the barriers that they have, and then at the end of this, interestingly enough, you could try and ascend to the top of the tower without doing any of this, and then you just sort of get the bad ending, which is your guy sitting sad, staring out at the sea at the top of the tower. or you could do all the shit we just said and then get the good ending.
Well, you don't only have to create those connections, you also have to disable the Exile, the evil AI access points, which have very tiny stealth sections. These ones I actually didn't mind. I actually think, like, I probably liked stealth better because of these ones, because it was like a short and sweet thing that I ended with, and I now probably remember more strongly than some of the other ones, because it's like a one room thing, a quick pattern, and you're done with it in 30 seconds, as opposed to like Act 2.
I completely forgot about it because I thought it wasn't very additive at all.
Yeah, maybe not, but you figure out, especially I didn't like the find the hidden room thing better. They were never too far away from a teleporter, but it was still like maybe unnecessary.
Yeah, I was thinking about this and like, you know, the fact that you sort of had to like go back and figure out what was going on, or, you know, do a little bit of hunt and peck through areas you've already been, always kind of rubs me the wrong way. Like, it seems, like you said, a bit of a time tax, a bit unnecessary, but, you know, it didn't grate too hard on me because, as you said, they give you like a detector that tells you if you're close, and it's never like that far of a walk. But if it was, yeah, I would have been a little more annoyed, I think.
I actually think they could have designed things a little differently so that after you created those connections between the layers, you could have like the teleporter rooms right next to that, and you would have to walk through the new connection scenes you did in order to get to that exile room. Because I think there were some things I didn't see because I wasn't going to backtrack through every level, every screen, seeing what's changed about it.
Absolutely agree. I think that would have been way stronger if they like perhaps put the effects of your change between you and the warp point. Yes, absolutely makes a ton of sense. That would have been a good move.
But, you know, well, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking here.
Yeah, agreed. That is a Monday morning quarterback observation. That's what we're here for.
fair enough. Once you finish off the Exile substations, there's actually the last Exile thing, because you go to the top of the tower, and surprise, Exile's still around, and he puts you into this warped, broken dream world. So you're being, it's kind of like a distorted version of the worlds you've been through, or certain rooms in them, except you're being chased around by the monster again. And you have to notice, like, oh, this little bit here has changed because Exile's won, or something like that. So, small little bit, it has some climactic finishes. That little kid from Act 1 is back and helping you out. I thought it was, you know, it was workable.
Yeah, it's a nice sort of moment where it's sort of a montage of you ascending the tower in a fast fashion, understanding that you've, you know, here's the aid of the friends you've made along the way and the changes that you've imparted upon the tower to allow you to make your way through to the final destination, which is the unification of the tower.
This was actually a pretty nice scene, I thought. You finish everything up, you get to the top of the tower, and you see all the peoples all around there hanging out, being friends. Yay, we're all friends. But at the very end of it, when you're at the teleporting way station, for the longest time, you see four dots moving around in a particular pattern. And you're like, okay, cool, this is the dot screen, and you don't have any information about it, but you make the connection between, like, the devotees and the warriors or something, and then there's a line that forms between two of the dots. You make more connections, more lines form. Eventually, when you complete all the connections and everyone's connected to each other, it forms a tetrahedron, pyramid-shaped, that rotates around in a certain manner. When you get to the end of the unification scene, you see that all of the glyphs that represent the highest ideals for each of the peoples, for the devotees it was God, for the warriors it was duty, for the bards it was beauty, for scientists it was transformation, and for the anchorites it was exile. You see, it's all variations of this tetrahedron from different perspectives, which I never caught on, and I thought that was a really cool moment.
It was a beautiful moment, like seeing it sort of rotate, and each of the different aspects, each of the different sort of prime shapes or meanings of each of the groups being shown as it rotates really pulled it all together. Sort of one of those, see, we're all the same, see, moments that really hits in the moment. It was a really nice homage to what this game is trying to say about communication. And, you know, while the issues still exist in the tower, despite everybody talking, you know, the oppressed sewer slaves are still enslaved. But
they can chill out in the Abbey now. You know, I think that was just an offer of, like, just come live here, guys.
That's true. Well, maybe we see that one slightly differently. We'll talk about that perhaps in the post-roll. I think to your point, I really did like this ending sequence. I think it was very powerful and kind of like underscores the entire game's message about, you know, communication and the ability to unify disparate points of view through the power of communication.
One thing that kind of tripped me up on the ending for a while was that it's like, oh, everyone's highest ideal, and for the anchorites it was exile, and I'm like, oh, that's you mean that evil AI I just destroyed? That's interesting. What's going on? Like, everything, it seemed like the sour note in the melody for a while, but I thought about it more, and I think what happened, and I didn't read this right the first time, but Exile, the evil AI, was doing what the anchorites wanted to. I thought that he was, like, creating the discord and strife in the tower, but the discord and strife already existed, and so the anchorites responded by self-exile. And the AI was just kind of being like, okay, well, I guess if that's what you guys want, we're going to ramp it up to 11 here. So it wasn't that it was like the evil AI was their highest ideal, but it actually was their highest ideal, and the AI was working towards that.
Right. The highest ideal of these specific people was, in fact, you know, solitude or exile, as you might say. And so it was... It was doing a universal paperclip on the tower.
I think it's like a thing where the AI was named Exile, and it's also like the word Exile. It was like a homophone even within the game. And I didn't catch they were talking about the thing instead of the AI.
Yeah, it is a little confusing in that regard. But to your point, I hadn't thought too much about why the AI did what it did. But it makes total sense now that you mention the ideals of the Anchorites and perhaps what their creation that they created to basically perform their duties so they could live out their days in Call of Duty would do. All right, with that, let's sum up our thoughts on our journey up the tower with a three-word review. My three-word review is stratification, translation, unification. When I first began Chants of Sennar, I did not realize I would be learning about an entire cultural ecosystem of stratified classes that resided within the game's Tower of Babylon-like setting. During your journey up the tower, you'll encounter various peoples and their languages, and importantly, your character knows none of them, leading to frequent and very entertaining instances of miscommunication. However, you are the hero after all, and instead of a rusty sword by your side, you defeat this game's primary antagonist, the Dragon of Misunderstanding, with your trusty Blade of Translation aided by the Shield of Observation and a healthy dose of deductive reasoning. Eventually, you help the Tower citizens reconnect as a translator, aiding them in understanding each other's problems and how they might support each other to resolve them, and that is a very hopeful message. But Chants of Sennar is a game about how stratification and feelings of alienation give way to unification through the power of communication and seeing things from others' point of view. It's an idealistic message for sure, but an important one to keep in mind regardless.
Very nice. My three-word review is language as playground. Chants of Sennar boldly goes where few games have gone before, linguistics. It's a topic that fascinates me, and I love to see games that take a big risk with novel mechanics. Chants works as a puzzle game both in its tentpole translations and its environmental puzzles. The translations are paced right, starting off in the concrete with Acts 1 and 2 before opening up a whole can of abstract in Act 3. The game looks great, and the art and music really set the mood. As a great bonus, the game perfectly ties in its translation mechanic with its narrative theme during Act 5. While I don't quite think the plot of the game was particularly special, I do love it when you resolve a plot through the game's key mechanics. Well, you know, unless that mechanic is something like shoot things. Chants is a game well worth playing, even if you aren't a linguistics nerd like me.
Agreed.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please share it with folks you think might enjoy it as well. Feel free to drop us a note at pixelatedplaygrounds@gmail.com or hit us up on X Twitter @PixelPlayPod. For us here at Pixelated Playgrounds, I'm Josh Galecki.
I'm Brian Skirsha. Take care and keep on translating. One thing that I wish this game explored a little bit more thoroughly is what happens when the communications occur, but it doesn't resolve the situation at hand. I'm talking perhaps about the fact that the piss sewer slaves continue to be piss sewer slaves, despite the fact they can go to church on Sunday.
Oh, man. Yeah, I guess we did take that bit differently there. I feel like this game definitely had an idealistic outlook on communication and everything. Like, what would have happened if the devotees couldn't play music for the warriors? They would have just been like, oh, I guess we'll just stay outside the gates then. It wasn't necessarily translation keeping them apart, but it's the differences between cultures there.
Maybe taking the example that I had, perhaps all of the bard slaves depart and go live with the devotees. What then happens to the bard society? do they conscript the warriors to go force them back into servitude, perhaps, because they view them as the chosen ones? You know, I'm just thinking about this logically in terms of how this society would actually react if some of the actions that were undertaken as part of this quote-unquote reunification actually occurred, because we're talking about a revolution. And those are usually not bloodless.
I mean, it might seem like he's coming out of left field a bit here, but there is that part in Act 3 where inside the sewers there's like a printing press where people are dealing out, be free, don't live on your knees. So it's exactly. Not like this isn't in the game here.
Yeah. I'm agreeing that like the ideas are present, but I think they're not thoroughly interrogated perhaps by the ending. I think this game's message is a good one. But I think perhaps that it doesn't deal with what happens when communications occur and yet still break down.
Yeah, it doesn't. I would say in response that the game is almost a fable. Like, it's based off of the Tower of Babel. So in that Bible story, you know, it's like humanity's trying to build a tower up to the heavens, be equal with God. God says, LOL, languages. And nobody can speak with each other, so they all scatter. This game kind of, I appreciate that it took that source material and put its own twist on it, that it's the differences in languages keeping us apart, and that the tower is unified when people can speak to each other again. So it's kind of, in one sense, supposed to be a reverse of the biblical story. So I think that's why it doesn't want to explore the very real world situation of communication not helping things.
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite of what the game's going for. So yeah, absolutely understand them not wanting to shine a light on that. I just think it's an interesting counterpoint, perhaps. I don't know. It was just something that sort of, despite the fact of how much I really enjoyed this game's ending, and I will, you know, all of the real world analogies in the world won't take that away. You know, it's still touching at the end of the day. It also, you know, upon reflection, strikes me as perhaps shallow, which, you know, a fable will. Fables are not meant to be like things you know, take out into the real world and put into practice. They're meant to be ideals.
Ideals and lessons, yeah. And I think that's a good point, too. I mean, I'm kind of reminded of, I don't know if you've heard the certain type of film complaint, like, this problem from this classic film would be solved so easily if they had cell phones or something like that.
Sure.
And the narrative drama wouldn't have occurred, to which I respond, that's correct. That's why no romantic relationship has ended since 2008 when cell phones came out.
Exactly. Everything's perfect since then. And boy, you really just turned me into a CinemaSins poster with that comment. And for that, I'm ashamed.